It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's day one of the federal government shutdown as negotiations between the White House and congressional leaders from both parties have failed to reach an agreement to fund the government.
Democrats in Congress are demanding an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year, as well as rolling back cuts to Medicaid and other health programs.
If the credits lapse, health care prices through Affordable Care Act plans are expected to rise for around 20 million people, according to the New York Times, and more than 10 million people could lose coverage by 2034, according to an estimate from the Congressional Budget Office.
Republicans have claimed Democrats are taking government funding hostage, with Senate Majority Leader John Thune saying he would be willing to negotiate separately on extending tax credits.
What does all this mean for Wisconsin? WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk is with us. Anya, welcome back.
Good morning.
Well, a shutdown doesn't mean all federal stuff shuts down. What are some of the key things that will still be running for people here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, in the immediate, for the vast majority of Wisconsinites, they might not feel the effects right away. You know, the mail still gets delivered. People still get their Social Security checks. You can still get on airplanes. TSA will be going to work. And so a lot of those elements of kind of how we interact with the federal government are considered essential and they'll continue functioning. People receiving food assistance through SNAP or WIC, they will still receive those payments at least for October. A lot of veteran services will stay open, but there might be some delays in a lot of those programs, especially if the shutdown goes on for a while. And if it lasts a really long time, there are some open questions about the reserves that a lot of these programs have, especially for things like WIC and SNAP.
And in your reporting, I saw another open question is not every federal department gave guidelines to states as to what they're going to do. So there is, it sounds like, some uncertainty on some of those less obvious areas.
Exactly. Yeah, this is certainly not the first time the federal government has shut down. But typically, there are these kind of contingency plans in place for shutdowns, and they kind of help explain how much money is in reserve to kind of cover costs, how workers should be furloughed, how to kind of distribute the furloughs, these kind of just nitty gritty things to try to keep the wheels on the train on the track, I guess is the metaphor. And so a number of those contingency plans that get updated kind of every few years were taken offline earlier this year and kind of never re-updated. And so there are a number of agencies that are kind of scrambling to figure out how exactly to be complying with the shutdown order.
You talked to union officials for a couple different federal agency employees here in the state. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so there are about 18,000 civilian federal workers in Wisconsin, and then a number of others who work on federal contractors. Those are not federal employees, but they get paid by the federal government when they work. And some proportion of the federal employees are represented by these various unions. And so some of the people that I spoke to talked about just, again, that level of uncertainty of, first of all, figuring out which workers will be furloughed, meaning that they will stay home and not receive a paycheck, and which workers will be deemed essential, which means that they will continue going to work but not receive a paycheck. And so trying to figure out kind of plans for those individual workers in terms of how they will continue to pay their bills, what the next, you know, potentially several weeks of their life could look like. There is a lot of kind of angst and uncertainty at a time that, you know, these union officials told me that it's already been a sort of morale crisis in the federal workforce over the last the months that the new Trump administration took hold, that they've really been kind of targeting some cuts and other things towards federal workers. And so this has been an additional kind of blow to that morale.
On top of that, unlike in past shutdowns, President Trump has suggested that, hey, maybe we'll just permanently fire some of the people being furloughed. Is that something on the minds of the federal employee unions that you talked to?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Office of Management and Budget released a memo last week saying that agencies should get ready to reduce force. And so that's a word for firings or kind of permanent layoffs rather than furloughing workers, which has kind of always been the precedent for how these processes take place. Democrats said that's an intimidation tactic. And it's also not clear that that would be legal. There are pretty strict guidelines for how federal workers are meant to be laid off if they are to be laid off. But, you know, the Trump administration has been getting rid of federal workers in all kinds of different ways since January. And so even though there have been legal challenges to many of those processes, those lawsuits take a really long time to wind through the courts. And so, again, these union officials that I spoke to said that that threat is definitely weighing on people and, you know, that it feels in line with this kind of overall approach to trying to thin the federal workforce.
Anya, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR State Capitol reporter. You can follow her reporting on this at WPR.org. Jeff Pirtle joins us now, Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Secretary Pirtle, welcome back.
Good morning, Rob. Good morning, Kate.
You oversee the State Department in charge of things like child care subsidies, other family aid programs. A lot of that is funded all or in part, I understand, by federal government funding. What Wisconsin programs in your portfolio are potentially affected by this federal shutdown?
Well, to your point, Rob, most of our programs that we run, and a lot of them are from the state, the money flows down to counties, and so they're locally operated, are funded with federal dollars. And it's, you know, it's a very concerning time in our country right now. And I think the federal budget shutdown is sort of the most recent example of this. But, you know, I think there's two things top of mind for folks in these conversations. Anya did a great job sort of talking through what the nitty gritty impacts are. And I think, you know, there are fund reserves to be able to run the government and provide benefits. States are going to step up and ensure that in these critical programs that, that folks can continue to have access to their child care subsidies, that we can continue to run child welfare, you know, Medicaid, SNAP, veterans benefits. But there is a limited horizon for that. And, you know, these shutdowns, historically, we had one in 2019. I think it was like 5 weeks. They're historically relatively short. But I think we have a really unprecedented administration, and no one is really sure how long this is going to go or what the end game is for the president.
Do you feel like you have communication from the federal government saying, hey, yeah, these types of funding are mandatory or essential and they're going to keep flowing no matter how long this goes versus this is getting cut on October 1st?
Yeah, I would say no. The amount of communication from the federal government is pretty limited at this point. I mean, we have a good understanding of which programs are essential and mandatory and whose money will flow regardless of whether the government is shut down or not, and where the more discretionary pots of funding are. You know, we've got contingency plans in place. The governor ordered all the state agencies to prepare for a federal shutdown. And I think that's one of the juxtapositions you see here. You know, on the one hand, you know, we look back at this summer, Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the state legislature, the speaker, the majority leader, came together to forge a bipartisan budget compromise, you know, and it protected and invested in childcare, in K-12, in higher education, it cut taxes. And nobody got exactly what they wanted, but it is a stark difference about how to achieve bipartisan governance and kind of what states are doing compared to the sort of chaos and disarray we see playing out in D.C. And frankly, on social media. And at the end of the day, I think this is really a failure of leadership from the president. I mean, when he wanted to pass his domestic policy priorities, he was working the phones and arm twisting members of Congress. He was cutting healthcare benefits to fund his tax cut agenda. But when it comes to running his government here in the fall, they control both houses of Congress and the presidency, and yet we're in shutdown. Seems pretty clear where the responsibility for that lies.
Now, for people in Wisconsin who are saying there's a shutdown, hey, maybe I receive these child care subsidies, or maybe I've participated in the Wisconsin Works program that gives some cash assistance and employment services, what do you tell them about whether these programs are still going to be there next week, next month, if this shutdown continues?
You know, I think what we're telling folks, what the health services agencies are telling folks is we can continue to fund these programs in the short term. And I would say, you know, people wonder what that exactly means. You know, if this shutdown looks and feels like the ones that we've seen before, and it's a couple of weeks or a month, then we're going to be okay. If this stretches on, if this is a long-term government shutdown, and I think there's real concern that might be the case, we're going to be in uncharted waters. You know, one of the things I think the president and his administration have clearly demonstrated is both a willingness to be unprecedented in their exercise of power and the sort of what I call winning by default strategy, which is, you know, they're going to do a thing and maybe in 6 months or a year or 2 years, a court's going to unwind that and say you couldn't do that. But the damage is already done. And you've heard rhetoric from the president you know, he's talked a lot about retribution and targeting. We see this both in sort of how they're navigating the justice system. But he's expressly said once the government shuts down, he's going to target programs and priorities that he thinks Democrats like. We're, you know, frankly concerned that there are a number of things that either were proposed for elimination in Project 2025, like the Head Start program, or in the president's previous budgets, like the Community Service Block Grant, that members of Congress in their budgets have protected and funded. But now that Congress is sort of out of the picture for all intents and purposes, and the president and Russell Vought at OMB, Office of Budget and Management, can sort of make wide-ranging, very powerful and potentially extremely damaging executive decisions, very concerning about where that's going to leave us in the next few weeks.
A director from the Office of Management and Budget, you just mentioned them, called for agencies like yours to avoid repurposing balances from previous years to fill funding gaps from a government shutdown. Is that something that's going to limit flexibility here in Wisconsin?
100%. I mean, that's a it's an unprecedented direction. It is very common in federal programs. Allocations come to the states. We're able to carry over balances depending on what's going on with utilization. And those are exactly the kind of tools states use to manage through crisis moments like this. And to be told don't do anything that could essentially serve the people is a profoundly unusual and, frankly, I think dangerous directive from the federal government.
Briefly, you've mentioned short term, probably things can be funded, and a vague sort of medium to long term that wouldn't be. When do you start to really sweat?
Oh, I started sweating months ago, but I think, you know, we're in the crisis. We hit the tipping point and the peak. It's hard to say exactly. It's going to vary across the programs, but I would say we got a solid month that we can do this. And after that, all bets are off, and it's going to vary a lot by program.
Secretary Pirtle, thanks again for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thanks for covering this morning. It's a really profoundly impactful issue that's impacting a lot of folks in Wisconsin.
Secretary Designee Jeff Pirtle manages the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Earlier, we heard from WPR State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk looking at the impact of day one of the federal government shutdown here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a federal judge ruled workers who receive federal disability payments should also be able to get unemployment benefits from the state. A labor attorney has an update on this class action suit and recent legislation on this issue.
In these laws that were passed, there was this stereotype that once you are disabled, you stop working completely. And that simply is not true.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent months, state government officials have been going back and forth over whether workers who receive federal disability payments should also be eligible to get unemployment benefits from the state. And if so, how much?
A draft bill in the state legislature would revise Wisconsin's unemployment insurance law. That bill would repeal existing laws that prevent people who receive Social Security disability benefits from also getting unemployment benefits if they lose their job. But the bill would also introduce a limit on how much they can receive.
The state ban on receiving both types of benefits went into effect a dozen years ago. Republican lawmakers decided that getting both disability and unemployment benefits constituted double dipping or even fraud.
But in a class action lawsuit brought by Wisconsin workers, a federal judge ruled last year that the laws discriminate against people with disabilities. Now the State Department of Workforce Development is being asked to compensate people who were denied jobless pay over the last decade.
For a look at this issue, we're joined by labor and employment attorney Victor Forberger. He represented some of the plaintiffs in the class action suit. Victor, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's lay some groundwork here. What makes someone eligible for Social Security disability insurance, and then what makes someone eligible for unemployment insurance?
Well, we all are paying into the Social Security system. So, and usually you get Social Security when you hit your designated retirement age. But there's a program in effect for those who get disabled at some point in their lives. You know, you lose your legs, something happens to you, a mental illness, something that prevents you from working. And the technical term for Social Security purposes, you can no longer participate in substantial gainful activity. When that happens, you then become eligible essentially for your Social Security benefit early. So you may be at age 40, you become disabled, you apply for SSDI, and that's a cumbersome, complicated process. You get approved, and then you start getting you're getting your Social Security benefit early, and that's called Social Security Disability Insurance or income or SSDI.
And then in turn, unemployment insurance. Is that for anyone who loses a job?
Yeah, unemployment is a completely different orientation. Unemployment is based on when you lose work through no fault of your own, and the amount you get is based on your earnings from a prior year in all your employment. So whether it's part-time, full-time, whatever that is.
So the 2013 and 2015 laws that were based on the assumption that people who do get disability benefits don't work and therefore shouldn't get unemployment insurance, is it common for people who are on disability to work, to supplement their income?
Right. Like most people who get Social Security continue to work after they retire to some extent because they need additional income to be able to support themselves. Disabled folks are no different. That Social Security benefit they're receiving usually is not enough to live on, so they need additional work. And in fact, Social Security has a whole host of programs that help people with their disability find full-time work and to stop receiving SSDI benefits. You know, and typically, many of these programs are under the umbrella called Ticket to Work. So lots of disabled people who get SSDI benefits work either part-time, some even full-time, because that's what they need to do both to support themselves and to return to, you know, substantial gainful activity. The issue here is that, you know, in these laws that were passed, there was this stereotype or presumption that once you are disabled, you stop working completely. And that simply is not true. And so there was this false presumption or stereotype on the basis of this law that got created. And initially, the projection was it only affected about 50 people in the state. And then once it got enacted, the numbers started coming in. It looked like it started affecting thousands.
And so this summer, then, the judge orders the Department of Workforce Development to stop disqualifying unemployment compensation applications simply because an applicant also receives SSDI. Is that right?
Yes, that's what's going on right now.
And so what is the status of that? Where are we at?
Yeah, so it's a class action. And so my apologies if I have to go into a little bit of legal specifics here. So with a class action, you have to define who's involved, who's at stake, and who's going to get the benefits from this lawsuit. The court approved two classes. One of those classes is those who got denied when they filed their initial claims. So a little bit of background here. When you file for unemployment benefits, you actually have to do two different things. You first file an initial claim where you indicate you've suffered some kind of qualifying job loss in which you want to start claiming benefits. That initial claim, however, doesn't pay you anything. If you want to get paid unemployment benefits, you have to do something else. You have to file a weekly certification in which you have to meet all the criteria in that weekly certification to establish your eligibility to be paid unemployment benefits for that week. It's a complicated process in Wisconsin, more so than in most other states, where you've got to track this initial claim and these weekly certifications and which week you're filing for. And the claim filing process doesn't really help you track all that information. So one of the things now with this is, so people who may have been denied unemployment benefits in 2016 because of this SSDI eligibility ban now will have the opportunity to be paid benefits for the weeks they were unemployed. But in 2016, when they got denied, they probably didn't file weekly certifications for the weeks they were unemployed. So now they're going to have to go back and figure out which weeks they were unemployed in 2016 and have the opportunity to file those weekly certifications for those missing weeks. One of the arguments or issues we're having with the Department of Workforce Development right now is how much help the department's going to be providing folks to let them know which weeks they were unemployed and so which weeks they have to file for. And so The second class we have is people who were had to repay benefits. They were essentially charged with overpayments. So oftentimes people filed, they don't quite understand what their SSDI status is. They may have thought they were getting, there's another benefit program called Social Security Income, SSI, mm-hmm. that's not applicable here, not subject to this eligibility ban. People who are thinking they might be getting regular Social Security and not SSDI, people who are unsure of the amounts they're getting. So they didn't quite report the information correctly at the time and then got charged with overpayments. Some people, several thousand dollars of overpayments. Those who, you know, got charged with the overpayments, they'll get that money back. DWD in Wisconsin is very eager to charge fraud. So many people who didn't quite understand what was going on made mistakes and didn't report their SSDI status correctly. Like one of the named plaintiffs in our case, you know, she missed when she officially started receiving SSDI benefits by about 3 or 4 weeks. So she got charged with fraud for not reporting it on the correct date because she just didn't quite understand what was happening and just didn't know at the time. That fraud determination got overturned, but for a lot of, because she appealed. But a lot of folks who don't appeal or don't understand what's going on, you know, those fraud determinations still exist, and that's why they got charged with overpayments.
What challenges will the Department of Workforce Development face in going back and processing, you know, all of these denied claims?
Well, that's like you're asking me in a way, you know, what kind of challenges someone who's discriminated in the past has to overcome, you know, now compensate people for that prior discrimination. I'm not sure that's the right kind of question here. They have the information about when people file their initial claims, so they know the week at issue, and they know if there's any other determinations that were issued at that time for those folks. I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, who even keeps their tax returns from 5-7 years ago, let alone, you know, some unemployment documents you filed? Almost everyone I talked to when I asked them the option, you know, there was this little button at the end of your claim filing that said, you know, you have the option to print or save as a PDF. Anyone do that? And almost, I think, 1 out of 100 might do that. So the department has what people originally filed and what they reported. So it would be extremely helpful to the department to provide that information to folks. So when they indicate, you know, that they were employed on these dates on their initial claim, for example, they then would have that information available to them to kind of say, oh, yeah, now I remember I was, you know, and then I got this other job. You know, I got laid off in February and then I got this other job in May. So I need to file now for weeks in February, March and April.
Has this been difficult for your clients to navigate?
Well, we'll see. It's going to be because we haven't started the process yet. I know for a lot of people with learning disabilities, I help them file their weekly certifications because just for the most part, they can understand the questions being asked, but being able to coordinate the information and track which weeks are being filed, that is it's extremely difficult for people without learning disabilities. You know, you almost have to be a lawyer with your paperwork and tracking everything, you know, the questions you're asked and the answers you provide to be able to kind of follow through this process.
We're talking with labor and employment attorney Victor Forberger. He has represented some of the plaintiffs in a recently resolved class action lawsuit related to disability and unemployment insurance workers on disability who were denied unemployment benefits over the last decade may receive some compensation. And Victor has been helping people navigate the claims process. So now, in recent days, there is draft legislation that is circulating in the legislature to repeal the 2013 law. What does it seek to do? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it essentially tries to follow what the federal court decision held back in. You know, we got the original decision in July of last year where they said that the SSDI eligibility ban discriminates against disabled folks. So it's simply trying to implement that decision, say, we're not going to, you know, deny people unemployment benefits because they get SSDI benefits. Straightforward and very simple. What's been happening of late, though, is the department has always pushed that if the eligibility ban should go away, there should be 100% everlasting eternal offset against SSDI benefits. So slightly different mechanism. Instead of just denying everyone outright, it's supposed to apply a financial offset against the benefits. In practice, it would essentially mean that no one who gets SSDI benefits would get any unemployment benefits, because 100% offset in the way, you know, the unemployment benefit in Wisconsin is now actually, we're the lowest in the Midwest. You know, in Minnesota, if you file for unemployment benefits, you get over $900 a week maximum. In Wisconsin, the maximum is $370. So it's a real problem. And the Evers administration took away that offset proposal, said we're not going to do that anymore in light of this federal court case, and a bunch of legislators pushed for that as well. Just yesterday, however, the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is made up of management and labor reps, reintroduced a 50% offset proposal. I don't know why. I don't know what the rationale is for that, but they proposed this in their agreed-upon bill to now institute a 50% offset, which essentially might mean that someone who gets a very low SSDI benefit and though has substantial earnings that qualifies for them for a weekly benefit rate of probably at least $250 or more may get some unemployment benefits, but only like $25, $30 a week, because the offset that would be applied against them would be substantial.
Going back now to the class action suit, what are next steps here for people to file, and who might be eligible? Can you give us an update there?
Well, notices should be going out right now. The court wants the notices to go out on October 1st. The department and the plaintiff's attorneys in this case, myself, Paul Kinney and Heath Straka, worked on notices with the department. We both made some substantial changes initially, but then we came down to some difficult, you know, DWD stopped budging on some of the proposals. For example, the notices need to have essentially three pieces of information. One is, you know, the two pieces of information must be the two classes that are subject to this eligibility issue. Mm-hmm. And you've got 90 days to file.
Okay.
So once those notices go out and you receive that notice, we want to emphasize all three of those criteria, especially the 90-day limit, because we don't want people to wait too long or think they can, you know, there'll be exceptions after the 90 days, because there probably isn't going to be any exceptions. DWD did not want to, you know, provide, you know, very direct, pointed information to folks.
What documentation will people need to provide?
Well, they're going to have to identify themselves, and that's a complicated process now. Most likely, when you call by phone, you know, most people are going to have moved. And let's say, since if you've last filed for an appointment in 2016, you likely live at a different address now, maybe in a different state. So tracking those folks, finding out who they are, and getting them the information, then calling DWD and making sure they're the right person, because we're really concerned about people trying to call up and file fake claims. So we're hoping that DWD will actually work with the Social Security Administration on verifying people, because right, if you're claiming SSDI benefits and I move to Ohio, you know, Social Security Administration will have that information. They'll know that, you know, now that I'm living in Ohio, but in 2016 I was living in Wisconsin. So if DWD can coordinate with Social Security Administration, that will make things a lot simpler. And that's one of our requests, is for DWD to do that. If you're using the portal or every kind of criteria, there's forms that have to be filled out. The main initial hurdle is going to be simply verifying who you are, making sure you're the right person. Then for those who are due overpayments, it should be pretty straightforward. Once that information is verified, you've got a bank account or debit card to get that information, DW should be processing that pretty quickly. Those who need to still file weekly certifications, that's going to be more complicated. What we're urging is for DWD to kind of provide people some of the information that DWD has on file to folks to help them kind of refresh their recollection about their unemployment history and what they were claiming.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, would these notices have information or assistance for people to know where to turn to get some help in the process?
Yeah, that's essentially is. And we're going to have there's going to be a plaintiff's website as well, where I think we will have more information about kind of issues and questions you can bring to DWD, because, and ask for that kind of information.
After this class action lawsuit concludes and the compensation has gone out, what have we learned through this? What is the outcome here?
Well, the whole SSDI eligibility ban was one of these things that got passed very quickly without a lot of thought. And I said initially it said it only affected at most 50 people. So pretty invalid information. You know, if you want to pass laws and legislation, it's really important to study them, do it right, get some good background information, and figure out exactly what this proposal is supposed to do and why. You know, that's like the SSDI 50% offset right now. It seems to me it just kind of done in a not very clear process and done with not very clear objectives and without any kind of forethought about what it actually does and why. You know, Wisconsin used to have this tradition of one of the reasons I moved here in 08 was, and coming from states like Florida and Massachusetts, which had a lot of, you know, political backroom dealing, it was nice to be in Wisconsin and come to a state where, hey, there's, you know, open discussion about these laws and what they're going to mean and what they're going to do. We've kind of gotten away from that in Wisconsin, it seems, or at least what I've witnessed, become more comparable to kind of a lot of backroom dealing. And it would be nice if we became more open and upfront about what's happening.
Victor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Victor Forberger is a labor and employment attorney in Wisconsin. He represented some of the plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit against Wisconsin laws that prevent people who receive Social Security disability benefits from also receiving unemployment benefits if they lose their job. We talked with him about the latest developments, including a possible compensation for those who were denied benefits.
Coming up, the UW La Crosse Planetarium is closing after this semester. The longtime director shares a half century of bringing the universe to visitors.
They think about the universe and go, oh, I'm totally overwhelmed. I don't want to think about it. I say, you got to be somewhere between. You want to be highly impressed, but not totally overwhelmed.
That's next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about hope and recovery. As a heads up to listeners, this story mentions abuse.
People working through addictions or tough times in their lives often turn to things that bring comfort and support. Some turn to religion or a recovery coin or books. For writer Stacey Parrish of Appleton, she held on to something much more organic.
I used to lick rocks when I was a little kid. Oh, trust me, it's the least of my childhood oddities. But I'd lick them because I figured out that rocks are prettier when they're wet. The colors are so much more vibrant and detailed, and I'm an artist, so seeking colors in nature has always been my jam. I'd sit on top of a pile of landscaping rocks in front of the barn in our backyard, and I'd pick them up one by one, looking closely at each one of them, just to take in their colors and their textures. And my pockets were always full of them. There wasn't a lot of safety in my world, but atop that pile of rocks, I felt safe. At home, I felt more like myself than anywhere else in the world, just sitting there seeking. It felt purposeful somehow, even if I was just licking rocks to see their pretty colors. I didn't grow up in a house full of seekers or with any faith to speak of. Not really. My mom referred to herself as a recovering Catholic, and she told tales of the nuns that used to rap on her knuckles with a ruler. I always referred to her as a Catholic rebel because we always left Mass at communion so she could get out of the parking lot without any hassles, and she'd joke that the peace be with yous seemed to wear off when we all got into our cars. inside Mass, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit just completely mystified me. It didn't compute. They were just names that I didn't connect to at all. The best part about church for me was that torn-in-half piece of doublement from the bottom of my mom's purse, even though it was covered in purse dirt and tasted like perfume. In my 30s, a need for faith revealed itself when I began to have memories of repressed abuse surface, and my perpetrators were my father, his son, and a cousin. So I did develop some faith, but it was in booze and weed and tequila. I suppose you could say I worshipped at the altar of Jose Cuervo. I found my way into recovery through a 12-step program. When I went to my first meeting, they gave me a plastic white poker chip to carry in my pocket in order to remind me to surrender to the program. And for a time, I did carry that chip around in my pocket and tried to surrender to the male version of God that I grew up with, but something about turning to the Father didn't feel right. My therapist sent me to a recovery retreat, and while there, we were gifted a token to help with our faith. A long table with a black tablecloth was covered in polished stones. Our leader let us know that we didn't need to fret over which rock to choose. She said, "You don't choose the rock. The rock chooses you." There were so many beautiful stones to choose from, and my gaze landed on a smooth purple one. It had these really cool striations in it, like a chevron, and it reminded me of a mountain that you can climb. I picked it up and held it. I looked at it real close. No, I didn't lick it, but I did start carrying it around in my pocket. A week or so later, after a 12-step recovery meeting, I noticed a pendant around a woman's neck, and I recognized it as the same rock that I was still carrying around in my pocket. Her pendant was wire-wrapped and just exquisite. I commented on it, and she said it was an amethyst. She said that she never took it off because amethyst is the stone of sobriety. And right then, I knew. I had gotten my rocks back, and my faith lived in them. They hold the energy of the earth and of goodness and hope. And if I ever feel afraid or lost or alone, I only need to reach into my pocket and hold on.
Stacy Parrish is a storyteller and podcast producer who lives in Appleton. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lolan Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. The planetarium at UW-La Crosse has educated the community on deep space and the night sky for nearly 60 years, but its long history is coming to a close at the end of this semester.
The school is demolishing Crawley Hall, which houses the planetarium, to build a new Prairie Springs Science Center.
But the building upgrade will leave the college without the projection room that has hosted hundreds of thousands of visitors over the decades.
Bob Allen has been the director of the UW-La Crosse Planetarium for close to half a century. He's also emeritus professor of physics and astronomy. Bob, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
What is it about planetariums that you think is so good, not just at capturing our attention, but maybe being that gateway into a love of science, astronomy, and beyond?
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the first planetariums came out, I won't say early in the 1900s, but a ways into them. But in the United States, there was a fellow named Armin Spitz. He was German, moved here after World War II. So the planetarium itself, there weren't many available except in big cities, Adler and Hayden and so forth. But with time, they became where they could be mass produced. And the key to me was the space race between the former Soviet Union and us in the 60s. There's a program now called STEM, science, trying to create scientists and engineers. So the federal government paid one half of any planetarium put into a school, didn't matter what level it was. Inner city schools, they paid 100%. Now, I'm not talking about the sound system, the audiovisual. I'm talking about the machine and the dome and the seats and the console in the room. So bottom line is that there was this explosion in the 60s for good reasons, the race for the moon. Lyndon Johnson, JFK, by the end of the decade, we will put a man on the moon, and they did. So to me, that opened the doors for number one, people go to planetariums, and number two, for people like me who are trying to educate people about astronomy, to have a way of doing it other than talking in a classroom.
What has led to this decision now for UW-La Crosse to close the planetarium as part of a construction project?
So let's go back to 2011. At that point, there was a meeting at the Cleary Alumni Center here in La Crosse by Val Schutte, River Architects. And they said, in 6 years, we're going to put up phase one of what is now called the Prairie Springs Science Center, where our parking lot used to be for Cowley Hall. So what happened was phase one went up exactly as planned. I won't go through gory details, but there was a holdup on funding for phase two. And that went on for several years. The building cost went up from $60 million to $150 million. So the magnifying glass got out and looking at what do we have to have to, and we have a very strong sciences in general, especially the health sciences here at UW-La Crosse. And they have a reputation around the country almost for the physical therapy and other health profession things. So bottom line is there was a delay in the funding for the phase two, and the construction cost in 6 to 8 years went through the roof, literally. And they just had to make some decisions about what could they do to be able to deliver the product they need.
And it's got to be a difficult moment for you. You've been attached to this planetarium. What does it mean to you to see it going away now?
First of all, it does take a little piece of my heart and soul out with it. But the rationalization I use here is I had what we called assistants. Back when I taught, they were lab tutors, they were observing assistants, and they were planetarium assistants who could do programs on their own if I was too busy between office hours and teaching astronomy one and two and doing programs that I could do. So bottom line is that I've had several dozen student helpers over the years. And three of those actually turned into planetarium directors in Waukesha, Minneapolis, and the University of Maine. But the bottom line is that the planetarium, to me, was a part of my job, and I would like for it to continue. And there was plans for one in the building originally. So let's get to the punchline here. That is, a former student of mine, not a student helper, but a former student of mine, Chad Wilkinson, teaches astronomy and physics and runs the planetarium at Central High School here in La Crosse. So in the past, Central High School had a planetarium and had some meat equipment and so forth, but they always said, you do public programming and quote unquote, we don't want to step on your shoes. But Chad Wilkinson for the last year has tried a couple public programs a month. And he is, because they put some major amounts into upgrading the place, both the look of the facility and the digital projector, which can do much more than the stars, the sun, the moon, and planets. Any database, government or private or otherwise, they can show on their domes. So bottom line is that the way I put it is Chad is going to be, quote unquote, carrying the torch, that they are willing to, number one, expand the public stuff. They have been doing school stuff for their school district, whereas we get the outlying surrounding, but they may be willing to do those as well. And we have an entertainment program called Alban Counters. It's a multimedia light and laser show to music. And bottom line is that he's going to try to start doing a little bit of that. So he's going to try and carry the torch and take up the slack and let the La Crosse community have a place to go for a planetarium.
We're talking about the closing of the UW-La Crosse Planetarium with longtime director Bob Allen. You're not closed yet, Bob. What do you have in the works for the grand finale for the planetarium?
Okay, the way I put it is we're going out with a bang, not a whimper. Let me take the two main ones. Number one, the public programs on Saturdays. We do a monthly series. Most school years, October, November, December, February, March, and April, six programs, but the building is going to be closed in December. So we are doing every Saturday in October, we're doing the Dawn of Astronomy. It looks at Stonehenge and places around the world where before telescopes were around that they made astronomical observations that helped them understand the seasons, the calendar, and lots of basic astronomy things. So the thing is, we've decided what the October program is. I just said that's at 1 o'clock on Saturdays, every Saturday in October. We'll also do every Saturday in November and two or three. We usually do three Saturdays in December, a Christmas star program or one called Winter Wonders about winter solstice celebrations around the world. So we're going to have three monthly programs, October, November, and part of December before we have to shut things down. The music programs, album encounters, Friday nights, we do, oh my gosh, Pink Floyd. We love it. Just sets the mood of the planet here. But The Dead, The Doors, Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, The Beatles, Tom Petty, Bob Dylan, you name it. So we have had, over the years, the numbers for those light laser shows have gone down somewhat. But bottom line is, because everybody knows this is their last show, oh, I went there a long time ago and I only got a few more shots. So we have had three Friday nights. And we did a band called Spirit, the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus, week one. We did Pink Floyd, Adam Harp Mother, week two. And last week we did Black Sabbath, Paranoid. This week we're doing Led Zeppelin. So the bottom line is that those programs are going to go on. If I get overflow crowds and have to start the program early and enough people say I'll come back for a second show an hour, a little over an hour later, we could hold about 50 people and we had 44 last week. So I'm not planning on doing second shows, but from the rumblings I'm hearing about the interest that people have, and especially the way the media around here have put it out there to the public about the fact that it is going to be closed.
Bob, you've introduced people to a lot of amazing concepts. One concept you seem to have trouble with is retirement. You've come in and out for a while. Yeah. What is next for you now?
So I taught with the Planetarium as a part-time release from roughly 1969 to 2003. I took state retirement at 59 years old. I kept the Planetarium 3 years because the person we hired for the teaching, unlike me, had to do research and said, I'll take your job, but I can't do the Planetarium stuff Bob does. I retired, sold my house here, moved back to Tampa, St. Pete, where I grew up. It was around, you remember, 2007. So anyway, my wife's parents had health problems. The kids and grandkids were here in La Crosse. We came back after 3 years. So that was in 2010. So at that point, I took the Planetarium just part-time as a staff member, not a faculty member, as a tenured faculty member as I was for those 33 years. So the thing is, I have been part-time Planetarium director since 2011, let's say 14-ish years. And I'm a workaholic. I won't say I can't work because I could find some other job in my field. And I will adjust. And some of my friends who are partially or completely, more completely retired go, how did we find time to work when we were full time? So life is good. It's got lots going on for me.
Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bob Allen is the longtime director of the UW-La Crosse Planetarium and emeritus professor of physics and astronomy. He is with us today to share the legacy of the planetarium and the plans for its final semester of programming. Oktoberfest fans, we want to hear from you.
We're in the middle of the season of events celebrating German culture. Some Oktoberfest events already happened in September in La Crosse, Appleton, and Germantown.
There's still more to come, though. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to an organizer of an upcoming event in Cedarburg and check out the history of German immigrant communities here in Wisconsin.
Are you an Oktoberfest fan? Have you been to one this year, or do you have plans to check one out? Do you participate in the dancing and other events at these festivals? Tell us about it.
Email WisconsinToday@WPR.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Beatrice Lawrence, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.